You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions. Welcome to the Rock Art Podcast. This is episode 143. This is Chris Webster. And if you're hearing my voice, it means we don't have a guest today. So we're going to talk about Rock Art Panel as we've done in the past. And we've got an interesting one today. But first, let me introduce your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. Alan, how's it going?
Howdy there, Chris. It's always wonderful to do these. I think they're a podcast listener fave. We've gotten a lot of good feedback on these, and they really enjoy having someone who's an insider explain or have a perspective on how one might look at rock art and maybe get a better sense of what we're looking at and how to understand it. How's that?
Yeah, I think so.
And that, of course, is a controversial thing because many people feel that it's an affront to even try to consider or deconstruct from our pre-contact artisans what they were trying to communicate, because obviously the only person that really knows the details or nuances of this was the person that created it. And for us to better understand from an emic, from a standpoint of the culture that produced it, that's very fortunate and also takes a deep and abiding understanding of the context. Okay. How's that?
Yeah, indeed. And speaking of context, so let's talk about what we're talking about here and what it looks like and where it's at. So if you want to follow along, we're going to describe this panel and try to see what we think about it. There's a picture of this. You will link to the picture. It's on the Archaeology Podcast Network website. So if you go to arcpodnet.com/rockart/143 for episode 143, or just look down at your show notes and whatever app you happen to be listening to this podcast on, there should be a link to this recording in your show notes, and you can go to the page and you can find the image. Okay. Because most podcast players won't have images in the show notes. Okay. But if you go to the page, then you can see the images right there on the Rock Art Podcast page on the Archaeology Podcast Network. So first, what is this called? And then where is it?
Okay. It doesn't have a name. I called it the Six Anthropomorph Panel. It's in Little Petroglyph Canyon, which was also called Renegade Canyon in the past, but they changed that name to be more politically correct and respectful of Native Americans. Mm-hmm. It is the canyon, the only canyon that has been open to visitors who would like to visit and see and experience Coso rock art. It's on the China Lake Naval Weapons Center base. And for many years, unbelievable numbers of people, probably hundreds, thousands certainly, have experienced the canyon and had an open view of one of the most prolific canyons for rock art in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, I remember visiting it probably. I think the last time I saw it was about 10 years ago now when we did that project out there.
How did that feel? How did that sense, given your experience all over the world with archaeology and other sorts of elements, what were your feelings when you went to that canyon and saw what you saw?
Well, I have to say the first time you go there, it's a little bit overwhelming. There's so much to take in. There's literally tens of thousands of panels out there, and you're just walking through the canyon, and there's so much to see, so much to take in. You almost have to just, once you realize that, you almost have to just sit down and just take in a small section of it and just see what you can see, because you can literally walk around and look even behind some of the rocks. And it's not just the stuff that's as you're standing in one spot that you can see. You can go behind things and you can go under things and you can go around things and you can see almost every surface is covered in something. And it's everywhere. The rock art in that canyon is literally everywhere and it is phenomenal. And the artistry of it too, the complexity of it.
Did, Did you get any sense of its purpose or function or meaning just from viewing the images superficially?
You know, I don't necessarily think so because I think I was there twice. And I think on the first visit there, not necessarily, right? Because again, it was so much, right? And there were so many different images. There was a lot of animal imagery, as there would be in the Koso rock art to begin with. So maybe a feeling of like hunting or something like that, as you would expect in Koso rock art. But I think, as I said, the first time around, it was just so much. There really isn't an opportunity for your mind to just settle down and analyze.
Exactly.
So it was difficult. Yeah.
So one of the contextual elements of this canyon that I only recently began to understand is it's a subterranean mm-hmm. canyon. So what does that mean? Mm. How is it a subterranean yeah. canyon, Chris? You know,
if I were to interpret what you're saying there, it does feel like when you're going down into it, especially if you were to imagine water coming down here, because obviously it was created either almost completely by water in the past, or possibly even by volcanic action and just a parting and tectonic action. But it almost feels like in some places, because it is literally a canyon, that you are underground in some cases.
Well, you are underground because the canyon daylights on the surface of the ground, but then it descends and is in size deeper and deeper into the landform until it daylights in a huge waterfall over China Lake. So you're going mm-hmm. deeper and you're being enveloped by these, as you said, higher and higher walls of rock art, and you're getting lower and lower in elevation and going actually beneath or below the prominent landform. When you go and see the area, the first thing that comes to mind is, where's the rock art? Because it's not on the plain, it's incised and below the plain, and it only daylights at one point, and that's where the rock art ends. So then when you go into the canyon itself, you're going deeper and deeper, incising into a lower element. So it's almost like you're descending into the netherworld, because you're going lower and lower, deeper and deeper into this canyon. And again, wow. It of course daylights at the end and opens up, and water would fall down, a huge waterfall, and it would be quite a drop off. I think it's more than several hundred feet down to the bottom of the plain, which is there at China Lake, which is of mm-hmm. course a dry lake right there at the bottom. So there's that. On the northern abutment of the canyon, just there on the side of the canyon, is a very not prominent. So it's not hidden, but it's certainly not prominent. And also because of its age, it's not highly explicit. It's a triangular boulder. And the triangular boulder has a picture on it, a panel. Some would call it a codex. And it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 individuals. They are figures. The largest figure is a decorated common animal human figure. And then the others are smaller, and they're all solid body, but they look like they also have avian legs and perhaps avian feet. Five of them look rather similar. Now, those five figures all have their arms outstretched and their hands are up in the air. Did you notice that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And the sixth figure is much smaller. It looks like it's astride a circle, a filled-in circle, mm-hmm. with sort of a crescent superimposed over that circle. And that little solid-bodied avian human figure has a snake, an S-shaped snake in one hand and a wand in the other, with some sort of a triangular end to it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Almost like standing on a boulder.
So when I first saw this, I said, what the hell is that? I said, what are those? Okay. Now, above these five figures, it looks like they're hanging on to some sort of a parachute, because each one of them has this amorphous, this solid figurative element, just a polygon. I like mm-hmm. that term. It's a polygon. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 polygons above their head. So you go, what the heck is that?
It looks like they're paragliding. It
looks like they're paragliding. Thank you. Yeah. I didn't know what to make of this. And no one had really mentioned this. It's not sketched anywhere. It's not in the 1968 book put out by Campbell Grant and his associates. And because it isn't a prominent panel, I don't think anybody made much of it. I don't think they'd sketched it or mm-hmm. somehow rendered it or anything like that. So there was that. Fast forward to, I guess it was 2016 or so, or thereabouts, maybe a year or two after that. And Carolyn Boyd, who's a rather prestigious rock art scholar, put out a book called The White Shaman Panel. And she had a Pecos-style rock art mural there just above the Pecos River that she spent the better part of, I think it was 5 or 10 years, trying to understand. And so she wrote a book, very lengthy book, hardback book, hundreds of pages long, illustrated, and tremendous amount of scholarship with hundreds and hundreds of references, most of them in Spanish, I'll have to say. And she examined that and said, and made the argument, which I thought was persuasive, substantive, and well-researched. What she was looking at was a creation story, an ancient Uto-Aztecan creation story, where they had the five pilgrims that were led by the goddess, the moon goddess, and they were led to create the sun.
Hmm.
Interesting. And yeah. I said, that's interesting. And I said, but I can't really figure much of this stuff out. This book is way over my head. I'm not fluent in Spanish. It used a lot of analogs from the Huichol, who are the Northern Mexico people that preserved a tremendous amount of their ancient religiosity. And they're famous for this pilgrimage to mm-hmm. a mountain where they ingest peyote and they recreate the creation of the earth. And she also used the Nahua creation story and showed how similar they both were. And she said that this particular panel that she had showed the five pilgrims and they were holding torches, and it had the goddess, the lunar goddess there. And this was, again, the story of creation, the creation of the sun and the creation of human physically embellished in an enormous panel. And I said, that's interesting, but
okay.
It took me 2 years to figure that out, by the way.
Okay. I think that's a good point to take a break, and we'll come back on the other side and find out what you learned. Sound like a plan?
Sounds like a plan. See you on the flip-flop, right. Gang.
Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 143. And we are talking about this rock art panel, these six figures from the Coso Range, actually specifically from Little Petroglyph Canyon and near Ridgecrest, California. And again, if you want to follow along, take a look down at your show notes and click the link and you'll be gone. You'll be taken to the Archaeology Podcast Network in the Rock Art page for episode 143. And you can see the images that we're looking at. All right, Alan, you read this book.
Yeah, I read it and reread it. And the only way I could read it was so far above my head that I had to go to the index and look at each particular term. I'd pick one and then I'd cross-index and read what she had to say and see if I understood it. And I did that for 2 years because it was so complex and, to me, difficult to understand the intensity and the character and the rigor which this woman had for this panel. It won the 2016 award for the best book by the Society for American Archaeology. And she was authoritative in believing that rock art is not impossible to deconstruct, and it is a symbolic codex. And if you try, if you really embed yourself in the ethnology and understand the linguistics behind it, as well as the cosmology, the religious views, you can get there and you can find out, to some extent, what the natives were trying to communicate with their imagery. And I believe that's the case with this particular panel, as she has said before, for the white shaman panel there, the Pecos there in right there in Texas, Tejas, not far away from where my wife grew up at a place called Del Rio. And she's maybe half an hour away. Alan, so tell me, don't keep it a secret. What did you learn? Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. What does this all mean?
What I learned was she was telling me that this was a creation story. And this creation story was exceedingly similar within Huichol and within Aztec or Nahua cosmology. It had to do with creating a new sun, a new sun. And the new sun was created only by following a lunar goddess on this trek, this travel, this pilgrimage to a sacred place where one of these five pilgrims had to commit self-sacrifice, throw themselves in the fire. And by sacrificing themselves, they were recreated and created the sun. And what happened was there was a problem with that. That wasn't the answer, because they created this fiery orb, but it wouldn't stay in the sky. It was tired because it had been through so much to be created. It wasn't following the pattern of being anchored or moving appropriately in the heavens.
Okay.
So what they had to do was they had to push up the sky with their hands and set the sun properly so it didn't burn or freeze the earthly biota. Okay. So I gave it away, but of course, I think that the largest figure is the one that self-sacrificed, and it's the only one that's patterned, has a little pattern to it. And those objects that they're holding up in the sky are clouds. Those are clouds because in the discussions of Nahua and Huichol and even Hopi, the clouds are connected together as a cloud serpent. And the cloud serpent is responsible for bringing the rain. And the rain, when it's brought, fuels life. And since they're creating life, creating the sun, there's creating the first life that would be on the planet, both for men and for the animals, and it needed the rain. We see these particular elements there that they're holding up, and those are all the clouds.
Yeah. Okay.
And there's five of them. Five is a very important number to the Nahua, to the Hopi people, and these are all Uto-Aztecan, linguistically identified members of this broader stock. And they all have a very similar cosmological nexus in what they believe and what they say and how they do things. Why is it five, Alan? Five is a magic number because I think I talked about it in another podcast where we had what's called the Nahuyolin or the encircled cross, and this is having to do with fiveness. Fiveness is the vertical and the horizontal. It's five is the hand, and five is the cosmological center. It's a creation. It's got the various basic elements of the universe all connected. It's got the cardinal directions. So 555 is what we're talking about. That's why there are five pilgrims. So it's very important to understand that, that it's not just a random number, but having five individuals accompanying this smaller figure is critically important to our parallel or our understanding of exactly what this story tells us. Go ahead.
Yeah, it seems clear too that first off, the larger figure on top is very different. It's got something connecting its legs down on the bottom. It's got the almost hollowed out chest area, and that figure and then the one down to the bottom left of it are also holding another thing in their right hands to our left.
Now, I know that Dr. Carolyn Boyd thought that those particular elements are the torches that they had to hold when they were going through the darkness. There was no light. Oh, really? Yeah, it was eternal darkness. The only light was the light that came from the lunar goddess, okay, who I haven't talked about yet.
So this, just before we move on a little bit, so there's two things I did notice on this panel as well. First off, on the bottom of the panel, the legs of the lower figure are cut off. And on the right side of the panel, as we're looking at it, there's a huge, it's clearly a big, huge piece is broken off. And there's elements of at least one of the figures missing.
That are busted, yeah.
Yeah, so with this being Little Petroglyph Canyon, do you know if there's, do you know where the other part of this rock is? Is it nearby? And is there other parts of this, other elements of this that can be constructed onto this? Is there other important bits to this that you're aware of around? Or is this really the bulk of this single panel?
I think it's really the bulk, but this is common in Little Pet because you're talking about a major drainage that would be subject to tremendous movement of water and sand and rocks at certain points. And even after the major earthquake and even after that, I've seen elements and panels that seem to be busted up. But I think that what we have here is the bulk of what was meant to be communicated. Because what's interesting about this, and this is unusual, this is why I think this is further of value, most of the panels of rock art, petroglyphs, rock drawings, are not like this. What is this missing?
It's missing sheep.
It's missing sheep, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also missing this tremendous superimposition. Often, most of the panels always have things superimposed. This one doesn't. And what's interesting about it is I would date it to at least, 2,000 years ago, to as much as 4,000 years ago. So somewhere in that Newbery period is when they were representing this sort of theology, okay?
Okay.
This sort of religion. Now, there is another anthropomorph in this picture, right? There's another being in this picture. It's six. It's not five.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's that all about? What's this?
Yeah, sixth? I don't know.
There's a nice clue here. You see that S-shaped snake, right?
Yeah.
And that kind of thing that might be, a special wand. And this particular figure is the only figure that has an emanation out of their head, right?
Okay.
You see that?
Yeah. Looked like a lightning bolt almost, but yeah.
This is very important because that shows that this particular figure is prestigious. It is a leader. It is a powerful figure. Whenever we see that for thousands of years, when you look at religious pictures, that we have the nimbus around their head, right? That halo to show that this is a supramundane being, a supernatural, powerful goddess. And she's the goddess of the moon. Why is that? Because there's the crescent moon right below her feet.
Yeah, standing right on top of it.
And, which I thought back and forth, I believe that superimposed circular or ovate thing is the sun. because she was responsible for bringing these pilgrims to this venture, this activity, this sacrifice, this ritual, which created the sun.
Okay, how about this? Let's take a break. And then, because we got more to say on that, let's take a break and then we'll come back and continue this discussion. All right, back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 143 of the Rock Art Podcast. And again, follow along by looking down at your show notes and you can click through, find the images that we're discussing here. Okay, I got to lead off with this because right at the end of the last segment, you mentioned something. So the small figure holding the snake and the little wand thing, you said was standing on an image of what looks like the moon, a crescent moon, actually.
Yeah.
And also an image of possibly the sun.
Possibly the sun.
Which obviously seems to represent an eclipse.
Yeah.
And if they're actually representing an eclipse, which is a very significant event, especially a total eclipse, which this could be representing, which would be interesting if this were actually representing an eclipse, because you don't often see an eclipse. Well, you can't see an eclipse with a crescent moon and the sun. That's actually...
Yeah. Oh, no, but that's neat, isn't it? That's an interesting way of viewing it. I never thought of that.
Yeah. So if they were commemorating, or I guess not commemorating, but representing an eclipse because it was happening or had just happened, the idea of doing it with a crescent moon would be interesting.
It's perfect. And if it's memorializing, if this was the reason they were memorializing the creation of the sun at the time of this eclipse, then that would be a perfect explanation, wouldn't it?
And not only that, but we could go back and literally pinpoint the total lunar eclipses.
When it was
time.
A crescent moon,
we know when those happened. Yeah, it's interesting. But
wouldn't that be interesting if that came back to the Newberry period from 2,000 to 4,000 years ago when that happened? Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah. They're not. Yeah, it would just be. It's interesting when you have these astronomical alignments like this because they are very predictable.
Well, so the wand is something that I've always been curious about. And this wand reoccurs many times throughout the Kosos. We have the individuals holding these wands, and they have either a triangular or a two-pronged end. Mm. So as it turns out, the Hopi have a very similar cosmology to all of this. They have sun watchers and sun. They have an associated element they call the Aliseka clan, right? And they're in charge of dealing with the sun and having a key ceremony at the winter solstice sunrise that has to do with bringing back the sun. And I've talked about this before. What it has to do with is as the sun moves across the heavens, it eventually stops. And it stops for about 5 days. And then to the Native American, that's a time that is full of danger and precariousness and trouble and terror. But they know that if they perform the proper rituals and ceremonies and do the proper dances and are watching for that, then that would be something that would be necessary to pull across the sun and cause it to continue its travels back the way it came. And when my colleague asked the Hopi specifically what those wands were, they had said that's a diverse wand that means several things. One, it's the wand that we use to pull the sun, to get that sun moving back in the proper direction. And it has to do with renewal and revivification and the transformation of life so that we can continue to restore us to the proper balance with nature and the environment. So it's a balancing stick. And the person that my colleague spoke to was a Hopi elder who was a member of the Sun clan, the Aliseka clan, that is responsible for bringing back the sun.
Wow.
So that's a pretty good piece of evidence right there. Now, so that's that wand. But what about that crazy S-looking snake there? The S-shaped snakes are something that is legitimized or a hallmark for the Huichol use S-shaped snakes to represent rain.
Okay.
And rain spirits and bringing in the rain. In fact, they have S-shaped dough elements that are done to for this festivity or ceremony of bringing in the rain. It's the rain ceremony or the rain ritual. Now, why would a snake have anything to do with rain?
Yeah, I'm not sure. A lot of times they're associated with the underworld or something like that, but I'm not sure in this case. Or is it represent like a river?
No. So it is okay. A river, and it is having to do with its movement. Yes, that's part of it. So you can say the serpentine movement is like water. And yes, that you're exactly correct there. But for the longest time, I said, why is it rain? And they said, when I finally discovered it, I was surprised. So where do these snakes live? They live in the ground, in their burrows, typically, or somehow hidden. When it rains, they come out of their burrows because they're flooded. And so what happens is when you get a good downpour of rain, you see all these snakes moving out along the surface of the ground. So the rain brings the snakes, but as native people said, the snakes bring the rain.
Yeah, as we discovered at China Lake a number of times. It was terrifying.
Tell me about it. Tell me. I've never experienced that. Please tell me.
Oh, man. It was the worst, actually, because the...
Tell me.
The Mojave green rattlesnakes are absolutely terrifying out of China Lake. And after a good rain, because it didn't happen very often, but after a good rain, you're totally right. We would have to go usually in the trucks if it rained while we were out there, because you can't walk in that environment in the rain. It just, it becomes impossible to walk in if it's a really good rain. And you just wait it out for a minute and then you go out and literally snakes everywhere. They would just come out.
And I don't know that except by reading what another author told me. But you have verified that physiologically, empirically, from your experience at China Lake.
Yeah. Sometimes after, if it would rain in the morning, we'd almost have to go in for the day because it would be dangerous to be out there.
So the rain brought the snakes.
Yeah.
Snakes literally brought the rain. And that's how it seemed.
If we saw more than two within a certain period of time, we would just go in because it would be too dangerous to be out there.
It's too dangerous.
You wouldn't be looking for artifacts anymore. You're looking for snakes.
Looking for snakes.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
I find that to be remarkable that you shared that, because that really does testify to the validity of this indigenous observation that snakes bring the rain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fabulous.
It was something.
No, but that's fabulous. And if you look at this and in others, you will note consciously, not in this one, but others, that they use the triangular head to show that these are indeed rattlesnakes. Now, what I understood is that triangle has to do with the sacs of poison that are kept in the head of the snake, and that it's a poisonous snake because its head is distinctively triangular.
I think I have heard that. Yeah, I don't know if I can verify that, but I think I've heard that. Yeah.
There's something about the morphology of the head that will give away that this is a poisonous snake. Yeah. And so that's
speaking of triangles, what about one of the last elements we have time to discuss? That kind of character on the far left-hand side of the panel and his little
trap. He's wearing a triangular hat. Yeah. I have, and you know what? On that one, I have no idea. I do know that they have avian legs and avian feet, all these little pilgrims. And of course, that's because they're animals, they're animal humans. And these are liminal animals, birds, because the birds conduct themselves on the ground and in the trees, but they fly in the air. That's part of the story, that these avian human figures that are rare, that they're not common, are ubiquitous, are very uncommon and very... very frequent. They're just not uncommon. They're very frequent and predominate when it comes to these figures that are zoomorphic, that have animals and humans, a conflation.
Yeah.
And if you look at the Nahua, the Aztec symbology, their famous goddess that was excavated in Mexico City and sits in the Nacional Museum there in Mexico City. And it's 26 tons. It is a serpent-skirted figure that is also feathered. It came from the mother, the moon mother, and it has the eagle feathers on its legs. And it also has bird feet, talons. So it has that bird-human cosmology mixed together. I'm done.
Okay. One last question for you on this.
Yeah.
Of the 100,000 panels at China Lake or more, what made you choose this? What made you bring this to the show today?
It's the only one like this.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It's the only one that does an absolute perfect panel that shows the creation story. Mm. And there may be others, but I've never seen them. And I've seen a lot of the rock art that exists throughout the Cosos. And there are a lot of panels and depictions of this lunar goddess or a female goddess with avian qualities. I would say well over 100 or more that have those depictions. But this is the only one that tells the whole story. Interesting.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
Are you buying it?
I think I am. Yeah.
Our tall tale.
Indeed. I'm going to put both up on the podcast page. So we have an image of the actual rock art and the rock that it's on, but we also have an illustration. And there's one thing about illustrations that you got to know is, first off, depending on who does the illustration, there's two things you got to know. Because if you look at these, you might think that there seems to be a lot more detail in the illustration than there is in the image. And that might be true, but there's one thing you got to remember. This illustration was not made from the image. It was made by somebody probably sitting in front of that rock and doing this in who knows what kind of light and who knows how long it took them to do this illustration. So it's a very different thing when you're sitting in front of a panel of rock art and trying to do an illustration versus trying to look at an image and do it from the image, right? Because this is just a JPEG sitting here and being there is very different. Because I was trying to like zoom in on the image and there's just some details you can't pick out, right? Because the quality's not there. Right. But yeah, and this is why we do illustrations as well, because you can really sit and study. You can actually take pictures of it and do it in different frequencies and different color palettes and things like that to try to pull out some detail. And you take all of that and you produce an illustration that brings all of that together with all of the elements so you can really see what's going on here. And you end up with something that hopefully is representational of what the person who created this or people that created this was going for. So anyway, just wanted to point that out for people who may not be familiar.
Sounds good.
All right. Yeah. All right. With that, we will come back and hopefully next time. We were supposed to have a guest lined up for this one, but they had to back out at the last minute, so to speak. That's why I'm here. But hopefully one of our next guests that we have lined up, our producer has a number of guests lined up. Hopefully we will be back with a guest next time. But otherwise, if not, there's plenty more to talk about in the world of rock art. We'll be back next time. Any final words?
See you on the flip-flop, gang.
There you go. All right. See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.